All right, well, welcome back. We're ready for our second speaker now this afternoon, Sabrina Smith, who's a professor in the philosophy department at the University of New Hampshire. And she'll be speaking to us this afternoon on Mind the Gap, Explanatory Pluralism and Evolutionary Explanations of Human Behavior. Please join me in welcoming.
Okay. Let me declare at the outset that I find it difficult not running away with my own ideas, and so I tend to prefer to read when I'm giving talks, because if I allow myself to be myself, then we probably will be here all day. We don't want to do that. So I'm going to be reading, and most people don't like when, particularly when philosophy talks are read.
Doing philosophy, I think it's done well, and we have conversations about our ideas. But I also have some quite specific claims that I want to make, and I think in order for me to make those claims, sticking to the script is going to have a higher likelihood of being successful than not. So, scientists, philosophers, and indeed anyone who is theorizing about anything at all are likely to be variously and differently situated with respect to the subjects that they're investigating. Obviously, though, the ways that they are situated do not rule out they're addressing the same phenomena, at least that's my view. This diversity, this rough diversity, captures the spirit of pluralism, and this is whether we're talking about explanatory pluralism or methodological pluralism. I think there's roughly something there that gets at a pluralistic perspective. So I believe that that explanatory pluralism is laudable, not least because it is consistent with the fact that the world is organized along a variety of explanatory dimensions. In contrast, if one starts with a monistic perspective, one will assume that one must be oriented towards the phenomenon in a single, correct way. But those who embrace pluralism, as I do, reject the ideology of a single, correct explanatory regime. So I'm interested in human behavior, and I'm particularly interested in deep biological interpretations of human behavior. I'm particularly interested in grappling with the question of whether one can extract pluralistic explanations of human behavior from evolutionary theory. So evolutionary theory, we all know, is sort of the panacea for explaining a great deal about the natural world, and I think it's more so with respect to human behavior. It really can give us a lot, so the claim goes. I should probably declare at the outset that my research interests have led me over time to embrace a rather skeptical stance towards evolutionary explanations of human behavior. However, the animating question that inspired this talk had to do with the prospects for finding pluralistic evolutionary explanations of human behavior. And you might think, well, I don't understand. How is it that she's at once skeptical of any such project, but she's also saying that she's animated by the idea that there could be a pluralistic evolutionary explanation? Well, I feel very strongly that that enterprise is a flawed one, but I also want to be very clear about why the enterprise itself is flawed. So rather than rejecting the very idea that such explanations are not possible in a knee-jerky kind of way, I want to think about what it is about evolutionary theory itself and what it is about human behavior that seems to rule out the possibility of pluralistic evolutionary explanations, at least with respect to human behavior. So then I wondered, seriously, when psychologists and other researchers interested in human behaviors purport to explain human behavior or purport to explain some component of human behavior, I wonder, what is it that they're actually doing? And I came to the conclusion that they're not all doing the same thing. and that perhaps I can sort of think about what they're doing in various on various levels, so to speak. So one low-key answer to the first that might help us think about what they're doing in the first place is that they're giving explanations of behavior in terms of what causes them. That they are specifying the identified or the assumed causes of particular behaviors on the basis of which they often draw general conclusions about types of behavior. Those types of behavior believed to fall under the same causal profiles that they're interested in. And I think that this is a sort of straightforward picture if we're thinking about this project in a sort of a mechanistic way. One researcher might privilege neurological causes, another might turn to intentional psychology, and yet another might cite social interactions. But the key thing here is that they're all trying, in some sense, to find causes for these behaviors. I think there's another way, however, that we might think about what these researchers are going after. In this way, I'm thinking that what they're doing is more like cataloging. In a sense, they are determining what kinds of behaviors count as human behaviors. And this involves efforts to account for some set of behaviors that are unique or typically found in human populations, and to show how some type or types of behavior exhibited by some humans are examples of behaviors that are typical of human beings generally. So I'm taking that these projects are, the second way of characterizing the project is not a way that sees the researchers being interested at all in the mechanisms that underpin behaviors. They can be, but that's not their target. Here they're looking for something else. They're trying to see what is it that should count as a human behavior. And I think that this kind of way of going about things might have some ramifications for who and what counts as a human. These can be seen as attempts to fix the category of what counts as human behaviors, as contrasted with generalizable idiosyncratic features of some individuals. In this way, if the researcher's project involves examining human behavior as a biological feature of our species, this usually means that her explanations will be framed in the context of evolutionary theory. From this perspective, any account of human behavior that is not consistent with evolutionary theory will be deemed false. So what I'm going to be doing today is talking to you about pluralism with respect to evolutionary explanations of human behavior. And my position up front is that there can't be pluralistic evolutionary explanations of human behavior. And I believe I can make some case for why this position is one that should be adopted. In the end, I hope to have shown why pluralism of this sort is ruled out, and explain what the conditions are that are needed for a satisfactory account of pluralistic evolutionary explanations would be. So, what are pluralistic explanations? I mean, we have some sense. Anya did a fine job. I really like that paper. Now I want to study cancer, by the way. but what are pluralistic explanations? So we can treat them as explanations of phenomena from two or more different perspectives. At least that's how I like to think about pluralism, without getting into sort of the minutiae of whether we're talking about epistemological or metaphysical or other kinds of pluralism. So one accepts different explanations when correct for the same phenomenon, when those explanations do not contradict one another, all things considered, they illuminate the phenomenon in question. So, for example, the phenomenon of criminal behavior amongst Russian youths. I just decided that I was going to go real exotic with that one. That behavior can be explained pluralistically, and one approach might involve focusing on questions about the social organization of the state. Another might be to study the populations in which those youths are found to find out if there are distinct and unique psychological or physiological elements that are prevalent among them, which might, I say might, account for these behaviors. And yet another might cite economic factors or for the behavioral impact, economic factors or the behavioral impacts of environmental toxins. Though these approaches are obviously different, they need not be inconsistent with one another. And I'm going to suggest that depending on what one's doing, and depending on whether one is committed to some other, have some other commitments, it could be aesthetic commitments, it could be political commitments, et cetera, that these theories, these kinds of explanations are usually not competitive. So in my view, pluralistic explanations are non-competitive, they are interest relative, and they are intended to capture the metaphysical complexities and multidimensional character of the world. The idea is that the world is complex, consisting of various explanatory dimensions, and a monistic approach to understanding it will therefore not do in the majority of cases. So let me cash out a little bit. This is what I mean by non-competitive. It's sort of, I think, self-explanatory, but let me just be very clear that I mean by non-competitive that different kinds of explanation for the same phenomenon are not incompatible with one another. That perhaps one may prefer one explanation over other kinds of explanation, maybe partially based on factors that are in some sense external to the explanation itself. So it's not about the explanation, but rather something else that is driving the preference for one explanation and not the other. That there are plural explanations for a given phenomenon reflects the interest of researchers. The plurality of explanations reflect the diversity of approaches to asking and answering questions and the diversity of methods used to solving those issues. And finally, I think the most important aspect for pluralistic explanations, or of them, they are offered and are needed to capture the metaphysical complexities of all sorts that we find in the actual world. Another approach to thinking about a pluralistic explanation involve researchers thinking about questions and trying to answer these questions at different kinds of levels, the vertical level or the horizontal level. So researchers who are interested in the relation, for example, if any there is, between the size of the human brain and human intelligence might approach their project by asking a variety of different questions and offering a variety of complementary explanations. An explanation might be supplied that aims at the molecular level, if you so believe that genes for intelligence can be found, we just have to zoom in on them. The physical mechanisms that unzip DNA molecules to facilitate the replication of nucleotide sequences that are pertinent to the growth of the human brain might be cited if they're relevant or considered relevant. In this case, one's explanation is focused on a component of a lower level system, the molecular properties that are deemed to be causally responsible for the growth of the human brain. Although the explanation is ostensibly about the brain, its size, the explanation need not make any reference to the brain as a whole, only to the role of certain of those properties that are causally relevant to brain growth. Another kind of explanation might focus on the origin of the mechanisms for molecular unzipping that are at work in biological systems generally, and how they came to facilitate replication and, by extension, the replication of genes that are causally relevant to the regulation of the human brain. I use these examples in part because I sort of want to poo-poo them, but on the other hand, it's also because there are enough people who think that there's something to thinking about these kinds of issues, human brain and the size of the human brain and intelligence certainly can be explained by finding those markers, those specific genetic markers that can tell us definitively something about human intelligence. So these explanations, these are explanations at different levels. They address phenomena that can be approached either vertically, inter-level explanations, you specified, or horizontal, single-level explanation. And in the Russian case, the molecular level is metaphysically lower than the target of the explanation, namely Russian youths committing crime. That would be a category which is framed in the vocabulary of the social and behavioral levels. In contrast, explanations that are horizontal are internal to the level of the phenomenon in question. So, for example, one may explain the behavior of the washing machine, its agitation, in terms of the design of its drum and the interaction between the drum, motor belt, etc. The motor and the belt, etc. This kind of explanation helps one make sense of causal relations that obtain between the parts of whole systems by attending to some components of such systems. Characteristically, common sense explanations of people's behaviors are horizontal explanation. One's behavior makes sense and is thus explicable with reference to one's intentional state, roughly one's belief and desire, just in case these belief and desires are somehow thought to be implicated in one's behavior. So this general picture of pluralistic explanations that I think is fruitful and useful and is really at work in most of what's going on when people talk about pluralism is one that I endorse. I don't have specific commitments to specific point. The point of the framework for me is it gives me an opportunity to think about whether some kind of explanation that, or rather some explanations, could be offered for evolutionary, for human behavior from an evolutionary perspective that somehow straddles the framework that I've offered here of pluralistic explanation. So as I said, the animating question for me concerns the likelihood, in thinking and writing about this paper, the likelihood of formulating pluralistic evolutionary explanations, which are approximately true of human behavior. And my initial orientation was that this is unlikely. Perhaps stronger, it's impossible, but I don't think I have the resources for impossible, but that's where I'd like to head to. And my concluding position is obviously it's negative. I do want, however, to try and show you why I got to this point. So I take evolutionary explanation to be and to show that one may be able to explain human behavior very, very generally in terms of evolution. That's, however, a far cry from saying anything at all about specific kinds of behavior. So I do want to say I'm not off I'm not off the car, off the bus, is the way it goes, with respect to thinking about evolutionary explanations of human behavior. But that is a real far position from the position that one, I think, would need to get to afford evolutionary explanations that are pluralistic of human behavior. So everyone knows that the theory of evolution is simple enough, but I think that there are sometimes conceptual and theoretical parts that are not quite captured in ways in which people use it and ways in which they talk about it. So merely saying that one is using evolutionary theory to explain something does not yet settle the range of theoretical options, even though you're using the theory. It's typical for such explanations, evolutionary ones, to be framed in selectionist terms. I say typical. Certainly most of the people that I know and maybe hang around with, they tend to be selectionists. And many of the things that I read, I get a whiff of selectionism running through them more often than not. So although we all know that there are other mechanisms that produce evolutionary change, very many biologists and some philosophers, as well as others, privilege selection, considering it the most important of the mechanisms driving evolutionary change. But selectionists or otherwise, these accounts show only that the profusion of traits in a population is the result of certain blind, that is, non-goal-directed biological processes. That's the only thing you can get, whether you're talking about drift, founder's effect, or you're talking about selection. Claims that selection has taken place are indeed empirical claims. And for any dimension of organisms that one cares to address, the evolutionary forces that resulted in a feature, that feature, those features are in principle, if not in practice, determinable. For some traits, assessments that selection explains their presence are only in principle assessments. Still, biologists can use a number of methods. Analysis of structures across taxa, population genetic analysis of extant populations, comparisons with samples of extinct taxa, paleontological methods, ophthalmology models, you name it, to determine, to come to some kind of a judgment that selection has taken place. One may also come to a position about what evolutionary processes are responsible for the biological character on theoretical grounds. Using the abstract form of the theory of evolution, one may argue, in conjunction with supporting evidence, that random genetic drift or founder effects are responsible for the proliferation of the trait and not selection. But whatever the methods used, it is standard to assume that selection was at work. Many of those who privilege selection, and for some reason I decided to pick out Godfrey Smith, but perhaps he's been known here to some people here, I do know that he's a strong advocate of selection, and start there. He argues that investigations of biological features should begin with natural selection as the default setting for evolutionary explanations. If you like, he thinks that you should start there, and you only consider alternatives when all else has been ruled out with respect to selection. You've tried, and you're not able to come up with a coherent view that selection was responsible. I don't think that right off the bat, the method, the approach that we should be taking to thinking about biological method should be selection, and that in doing so, we're engaged in somehow a more fruitful enterprise. We're able to get better answers, answers that are correct, that we will somehow learn deep, important questions, answers to our questions with selection that we're not able and would not be able to get elsewhere. I find that methodological stance rather difficult to swallow. I don't see any reason, any argument to suppose that this must be the case. Of course, there are numerous cases where the evidence is so compelling that one can deduce that the feature under consideration is the result of selection. Notice I say here that there are numerous cases, and I'm thinking of those cases where you have reason, good enough reasons to conclude that the likelihood of selection is greater than something else. So compelling evidence to deduce that the feature under consideration is in fact the result of selection. On such views, selection has a higher net rate of causing evolutionary change than, for example, the non-mechanism genetic drift, particularly when compared to drift, since for some biologists and philosophers, drift is either very difficult or impossible to establish, or it is an empty notion that cannot be established empirically at all. As I said, it is an open question whether selection has taken place. But I also think that it is an open question to what extent selection is responsible for biological form. And if it is not clear, rather, it is not clear to me that being able to demonstrate that selection would have favored the usual language, selection would have favored a feature, that in itself is sufficient to push it over the edge into the selected for category. So the view that I have, not articulated, but it's certainly a position that I'm happy to embrace, is one that we probably should be a lot more moderate about our selectionist bandwagoning, or something like that. I do think, however, that there is an important reason why selection looms as large as it does, and it doesn't often, I tend not to see it being made explicit, but call this an intuition of sorts that I think is sort of driving part of why it looms so large. It has to do with the fact that somehow the sieve of selection has built into it the notion of function. That a trait was selected for is supposed to tell us that the trait did not merely appear, but rather that it appeared and did not pass through the sieve of extinction. And it didn't pass through it precisely because, all things considered, it performed better than the alternatives floating around in the population. Or more extremely, and I think less plausibly, because it was just the perfect optimal fit for the job that it's thought to be doing. So selection is obviously a notion that comes already packed with the notion of function in there. And since it seems to me that part of what we're interested in when we think about evolutionary questions about features of organisms, a part of what we're looking for is we're looking for origin explanations, but we're also looking for origin explanation that somehow tells us things about what those traits, those features are for. What is it that they're for? And what they're for surely has to do with what they were put in place to do. So I think this way of thinking is sometimes useful and is correct for explaining some physical, physiological, and morphological traits, as well as instinctive behaviors of non-human animals. But I think matters are less straightforward with respect to human psychology. The problem is partially methodological. Evolutionary hypotheses about human psychology are far less amenable to the source of empirical assessment that can be invoked to assess prototypical physical traits. But I can set aside, as I will, these kind of methodological worries, and instead I want to proceed on the assumption that the available inferential methods are in principle secure enough to allow for one to arrive at evolutionary explanations of human behavior that are approximately true. Even with these deficits, we can set aside these deficits, and we can sort of say, let's try things on and see whether or not we would actually come up with answers. We could get some answers that are fruitful, useful, even approximately true for human psychology, and by extension, for human behavior. So, with these elements in place, what I want to do with the rest of the time I have is to talk about the prospect for providing contentful selectionist explanations of human behavior. And the question I ask is, okay, so how could such explanations get secure? I think the task confronting anyone wishing to justify evolutionary explanations of human behaviors is to show that there is a tight correlation between the psychological mechanisms underpinning human behaviors and the kinds of behavior that they underpin. I think that this is a requirement for making the case that any given behavior type or psychological mechanism underpinning the behavior type is apt for biological, that is, evolutionary explanation. Given this, I think that there is a theoretical gap that needs to be bridged, but of course, it's one that I don't see bridgeable. So what I want to do is to draw a distinction, and this distinction is going to show why, at least I hope, show why I have this particular perspective I have. So I need to draw a distinction between the category human behavior and the category kinds of human behavior. Human behavior consists of behaviors that are typical of, but not necessarily unique to human beings. Think of this as a general capacity to behave in distinctively human ways. The notion of kinds of behavior is, I think, more transparent. Kinds of behavior are behavioral categories individuated in some way, perhaps by their causes or functions or effects. The kinds of behaviors and the category human behavior are not the same kind of entity, such that the explanation for one is translatable or can be transported to the other. So I think this distinction is significant, and I think it is so because I want to suggest that one could offer an evolutionary account of human behavior without this entailing anything at all about kinds of behavior or instances of behavior exhibited by individuals in any population. Here is how I'm going to try to do this. So because evolutionary explanations in the first place are origin explanation, one can say something about human behavior, namely that it is to be accounted for by facts about human origins, etc., etc. Nothing, I maintain, follows about the conditions under which the capacity itself emerged. An evolutionary explanation of human behavior is roughly that the capacity and disposition to behave in ways that are typical of our species was somehow a product of natural selection. Again, nothing about particular selectionist narratives or what any kind of behavior was selected for doing follows. So, talk about specific kinds of human behavior involves a lot more than talking about human behavior, the category. A kind of behavior is only interesting and is in need of biological, that is, evolutionary explanation, if its origin cannot reasonably be accounted for otherwise. For instance, if it is found amongst disparate populations who do not share the same or similar culture. In cases like these, it becomes attractive to attribute the behavior type to a culture transcending cause, more specifically to natural selection. I obviously reject this. So I reject the idea that human behaviors have been under selection. However, I don't think that for the most part this is what is meant when people talk as they do. I think that talk of behavior is a kind of shorthand for behavior producing proximate mechanisms. So the issue when people talk about human behavior, even when they're talking about human specific kinds of human behavior, it seems to me is really the issue of the proximate explanation for human proximate explanation for human behaviors and ultimate explanations for the capacity for human beings to behave. So I think if you are talking about evolutionary explanations of human behavior types that you thought were found or exhibited in some environment of evolutionary adaptation, and you believe that those behaviors, or at least the mechanisms underpinning those behaviors, were selected for, I'm submitting that what you're saying, what you're talking about those behaviors, and you're trying to make a case for the proximate mechanisms found in those
populations at the time when those behaviors emerge. You are offering approximate explanations for those behaviors that are taken to have ultimate biological function.
So, even when you purport to give evolutionary accounts of human behavior, now we are really giving evolutionary accounts of human behaviors types then thought to have been exhibited a certain way. So they had specific kinds of etiology. They had specific kinds of causal processes that governed them. It is that that we're interested in. And then we make an incorrect move.
And we say that those proximal mechanisms found then are the ones that are found,
that are present now. So that's, I think that the issue of the proximate ultimate distinction is really, really central.
And I find that it's very easy to sort of lose ground if your eyes not focus on the ball. What is it that you're explaining? We know that with respect to behaviors, we know that mechanisms can shift. In fact, we should accept that mechanisms shift.
So it looks like what we're trying to say is not something about the behaviors currently exhibited, but rather something, in fact, I'm maintaining. We're saying something about the behaviors exhibited then, and we make the problematic move of assuming that all things considered, things have not changed. You need an independent argument for that. You have to show why it's a good explanation to suppose that nothing has changed. All right. This is why I didn't want to riff, because now I don't know where I am. Okay. I'll get there. So the idea is that if it is a stretch to attribute the prevalence of a behavior kind or type to cultural learning, then inference to the best explanation, that behavior kind should be attributed to selection. This explanatory impulse, which at times can seem overwhelmingly attractive, typically brings other assumptions along for the ride. That, for instance, the mechanism is in some sense innate, that, for instance, the mechanism is non-malleable, or that it is malleable only with difficulty, that it has a fitness-enhancing function, and the like. So, you know, it appears that I'm throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I get these things wrong sometimes. That I'm saying, look, I just don't think that any kind of evolutionary explanation is ever on the table. And it appears that I'm saying that. I'm not quite saying that. I'm saying something that I think is a lot more nuanced than that. So I'm not against asking questions about the evolutionary origins of behavior-producing mechanisms, or of considering the kinds of answers that questions of that sort could invite. I just don't think that these are the right sorts of questions to start with. Now, you might ask me in Q&A, what's your reason for taking that position? Give us some reason. Well, there are all sorts of reasons why we shouldn't take that position, and hopefully I'll answer that question. Now, how can I maintain at once that there is sort of a single approach if we're thinking in terms of not human behavior types, but if we're thinking about human behavior, how can I rule out the possibility of pluralism there while earlier exalting pluralism? I did say that pluralism is a consequence of the interests that researchers have. And that seems to me to be right. Surely researchers can have interests that pushes them in evolutionary explanatory directions. And those explanations might be different. Why might that not suffice for a kind of pluralism of sorts? I'm not opposed to pluralistic explanations of kinds of behavior. Rather, I'm claiming that the sorts of explanations that one may legitimately give for human behavior, the category, are not what is in order for explaining kinds of human behavior. I do think we should accept, and I do accept, that human behavior, the capacity to behave in human, typical, distinctive ways, plus the realization of that capacity, evolved. But that doesn't license the further claim that there are true evolutionary stories that account for human behavior types. I have some reasons for rejecting this position. Two kinds of reasons why I think that this won't work. One reason for rejection is a kind of epistemological skepticism, and one is a kind of metaphysical skepticism. And the epistemological worries goes as follows. It leads one to conclude that although it might be true that human behavior types or proximate mechanism types underpinning them were selected for, the epistemic constraints are such that we cannot know that this was the case, and all the more we cannot know which, if any, factors were responsible for their selection. It's not simply that we can't know the stories. We can't even know that there's a story to be known. Why is this? Well, this really isn't the central core of the paper, but I'll gloss why I think this is the case. Psychological mechanisms do not leave a fossil record. And I think that that is a point that people sort of tend not to pay any attention to. Of course, we all know that. But what follows from that? Less well emphasized, but I think very important, is the fact that even if such evidence were available, there are problems with individuating behaviors and mechanisms. So even if in principle there were records in the fossil, markers, dedicated markers for human psychological behavioral types, we still would be plagued with the problem of how exactly we would be individuating behaviors and the mechanism that underpins them. So in short, determining whether a psychological feature, behavior type, was selected for, or what it was selected for doing, does not appear to involve inference to the best explanation, for the simple reason that we're not in a position to make principled determinations about which explanations are best. Some of you might say, well, this isn't a deep worry. I think it's a worry enough. Whether it's deep is another matter, but I do think it's a worry enough. I think it's plenty, plenty important. And of course, we might engage in interesting speculations about these matters, and in fact, I would suggest that we do that by entertaining the possibility that these behavioral mechanisms were selected for and generate, we can, from doing so, generate interesting hypothetical stories about how they were selected for. But engaging in this as an imaginative exercise is a far cry from formulating projectable alternatives. And from a methodological perspective, given the problems inherent in producing projectable evolutionary explanations of these sorts, and the availability of projectable non-evolutionary explanations, I'm suggesting that we should prefer non-evolutionary explanations of human behavior types to evolutionary ones. What I'm really, really most interested in, though, is a metaphysical worry. I want to sketch an outline of an issue that anyone looking for evolutionary explanations of human behavior types must get to grips with. The considerations offered, I don't think, are definitive. I'm not offering them as settling the matter, but I think that they at least can be helpful in thinking about these issues. They don't strictly rule out that there was selection for human behavior types, but they do cast doubt on that being the case. Human behaviors or rather human beings are capable of a high degree of behavioral novelty. Of course, lots of organisms can produce novel behaviors, but what I want to stress is the degree of novelty that's available to us. Clearly, we have novelty-producing brains. We are, for example, extraordinarily adaptable to environmental contingencies. Accomplished self-engineers that succeed in exploiting a hugely varied range of ecologies, all the way from the African savanna to the International Space Station. This degree of flexibility I'm suggesting seems to me to sit poorly with the notion that there were separate selectionist stories or accounts for distinct behavior types. Perhaps even more striking is the human capacity for creativity. We are and have been for a long time relentless innovators, fashioning alternative ways of coming to grips with environmental contingencies. We don't only find new things to do, we find new ways to do old things. And we can turn on a dime, adapting to novel situations at the drop of a hat. Again, this does not sit well with the idea that we're endowed with a fixed repertoire of distinct psychological mechanisms underpinning a fixed repertoire of behavior types. So folks like me, who are skeptical of the possibility of giving evolutionary explanations of human behavior types, are sometimes charged with claiming that evolution stopped at the neck. I obviously don't think that evolution stopped at the neck. The human brain, with its capacity for producing human behavior, was a product of evolution. But if the charge is that I think it is unlikely that types of human behavior were selected for, then I am happy to plead guilty to this charge. Now, I'm bringing it on home. So you might be wondering what all of this has to do with my claim that pluralistic evolutionary explanations of human behavior are not on the cards. I think if I'm right, it looks like all that we can do all that we can do or say with any assurance about the evolution of human behavior is something like, human behavior evolved. This is a trivial consequence of the truth of evolutionary theory. It doesn't really tell us anything about human behavior. This is too empty. It's too empty of content to provide us with the foundation for pluralistic alternatives, either of the vertical sort or of the horizontal sort. And we can't have pluralistic evolutionary explanations of human behavior types for the trivial reason that we probably can't have good evolutionary explanations of human behavior types at all.